Good morning, and welcome to Many Paths, Many Visions, brought to you by the Labyrinth Society and with your host, Christiana Brinton. In conjunction with the theme for the Labyrinth Society annual gathering this year, Diverse Journeys on a Common Path, Building Community Through the Labyrinth, our series for the remainder of 2016 will have a similar theme, Using Labyrinths to Address Social Issues. This is our second episode, and listeners can live chat with my guests and me during the 15-minute Q&A session at the end of the interview. This episode is entitled, Combining Art, Spirituality, and Service Through the Labyrinth. Making a Difference, One Labyrinth at a Time. And my guests today are Debbie and Marty Kermeen, two of the featured speakers at the Labyrinth Society annual gathering this year in Houston, Texas, where they constructed two permanent labyrinths, one at the Dominican Sisters Congregation of the Sacred Heart and the other at St. Paul's Methodist Church, where the gathering will take place. So hi, Marty and Debbie. Welcome to Many Paths, Many Visions. Thank you for joining me today.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Hello.
So you are both well known in the global labyrinth community, and there are many, many articles written about your beautiful work, and you have a work website called Labyrinths in Stone, www.labyrinthsinstone.com. So I'm not going to ask you like foundational or background questions, but I'm going to really just sort of jump into how you work together now. And so can you briefly describe what each of you provides for each installation now in each labyrinth installation?
Sure. Our duties overlap because we're both so involved. I help in the office where I can and with administrative things, and Debbie handles the majority of that, but she also does so much more. She carries bricks, she lays bricks, she does all the emails and helps with contracts, keeps me on point, keeps me on schedule. She does virtually everything, and I lay bricks on occasion. But the part that I find most amazing about what she does, and it became clear to me this year, is that she knows the right thing to say and do at the right time. For example, we were in Danville, California last summer, and it was a memorial for a young man that had been lost tragically to a traffic accident. And his grieving mother was there with us, and it was very emotional for her. Even though it had been about a year, because the labyrinth was being made in his honor, it was an incredible emotional journey for her. And Debbie seemed to know exactly the right thing to say at the right time and how to be with her and help her process all of it. And if I'd have been there alone, I'd have had no clue how to deal with all that. It was just too much for me to be able to wrap my head around. But by having my steady partner with me, that made it a better experience for everyone involved. And it's not just that, it's every labyrinth has its unique needs and spiritual side, kind of like the energy keepers from the Labyrinth Society. And she just does that so gracefully and elegantly that I don't know how I would do it without her. Seems like people expect a little more from us. It's not like having your bathroom remodeled where the contractor comes in and he's gone and you don't really get to know him that well. We're there for quite a while, and it's a process for the people that we're making them for. So it's a little deeper than that for us because of the expectations.
I would also like to say that Marty is very good at also guiding and holding energy as he's making a labyrinth. He allowed Dory, was the mother involved in the situation, and she would come every day to be a part of having this labyrinth be born as a memorial to her son. And they had found walking labyrinths together mother and son. So they have a very wonderful connection with the labyrinth that way. And every day she would be there to be a part of it. And Marty was so gentle and kind and understanding with her. He's giving me a lot of credit. He was also very wonderful at holding the energy with her and helping her feel a part of the sacredness of this labyrinth being born.
So is there ever a time when you you're not together? I mean, you like to, Marty, do you start a labyrinth and then Debbie joins you, or do you both come together all the time at the same time, or do you, how does that work? Are you always both together on every single labyrinth installation?
It has changed over the years. So just like, you know, many things, it has morphed and changed. Early on, when we first started making labyrinths and Marty was traveling, I was home with our two daughters and they were young. So we would, you know, I would be home with them while he went on these trips a lot. We would join him when we could, but with school and dance classes and friends and, you know, social life, it was hard to drag them away very often. So there was many times that we were at home raising the girls while he was making a labyrinth someplace. Now that has shifted and changed. Now our girls are older and on their own more. So now I can join him when it's needed. And actually Merlin, our little dog, and I would both come along with him on projects and help in whatever way that we can. And, you know, so things have changed and shifted a lot over the years.
Pretty much every combination of come partway through, come for the whole time, not come at all, any variation you could think of has probably happened over the 80-some labyrinths we've made.
So that's what I was wondering, you know. So when did you get us? Was it right from the get-go, Marty, and Debbie? Did you sense that there was more than just putting a labyrinth in the ground to the customer's expectations or specifications, right from the get-go, or was this a gradual thing? Did this sort of weaving of art and spirituality and service, because you're providing a service for this person? I mean, this is a monument to her son in this specific instance you were talking about. So was this it just sort of happened organically, or was there one event that really focused this weaving of all these pieces together for you?
I think that maybe each and every one of the labyrinths is a learning experience. But I remember a particular instance in before the first labyrinth that we made in Naperville, Illinois. We had a small crew of fellows that worked with me, and we were at a large residential project that we did in the 80s and early 90s. I was sitting on the porch with this drawing, a CAD drawing that had been sent to me from a guy in Carolina that I found out later was inaccurate, a CAD drawing of a shark labyrinth. And I remember spreading it out on the deck and calling the guys over and showing it to them and telling them, this is really, really important. I don't know why, but I know that it is.
And then that same project in Naperville, while Marty was building that labyrinth and our daughters, we would go and spend, you know, the weekends there and after school at the labyrinth with him while he was creating it. And I witnessed a lady walk up to the fence. They had it all fenced off and she was crying. You know, she just had tears rolling down her face. And it was just amazing to me that she was having such a moving experience watching the birth of this labyrinth, and we didn't know what it was. In fact, at the time, it was called the Dramanon. She brought us gifts. She brought us jewelry with labyrinths on them, and she brought us a poster for us to frame, and she was very moved by the process. And so that's really what opened my eyes to knowing there's something here that is way beyond what we can even imagine, to be moving her to tears like this, to see one being made.
She told us a story when we were there. She said, bear with me while I tell you this. She said that it's going to have a huge impact on people's lives. And at that point, it was just a really complex geometric puzzle for me, being the first one we had made. And she said that if one person a day comes to the park and walks this labyrinth and goes home better for the experience, just simply one a day, that's 365 people a year. And if you multiply that out, how long will the labyrinth last? Maybe 100 years, she says. So then you do the math. You're looking at 365,000 people having their lives altered in some positive way, better for the experience. And then she said, how many labyrinths are you going to make? I said, I have no idea. I'm not even sure I can complete this first one. And she said, trust me, you will build more than 100 in your lifetime, which seemed pretty astronomical to me at the time because this was the first time I'd ever heard of it. She said, trust me, you'll build more than 100 in your lifetime. And if you do the math, 100 times 365,000, you will have an impact on people's lives. So that was probably the point in for me that it rang true, that it was a very important thing to be doing.
So much so that to the point where, you know, there's been times where it's been tough and it's been like, you know, are we going to keep on this path or is it, you know, what are we going to do here? And it really keeps us going many times just to have the experience of seeing how it helps people. It keeps us on the right path of moving forward, even though sometimes it's pretty tricky.
And you mean that in terms of income, because this is your primary source of income, is it not, Marty? I mean, has it picked up? I mean, have you seen an increase or in the desire to have labyrinths from all sectors of society than it used to be?
Yes, there's been a great blossoming of labyrinth enthusiasm, in part to Labyrinth Society and Veriditas and it's itself, actually. I mean, you don't really have to sell it. It does its own thing. But I forgot the first part of the question. Say that again.
Well, I just wanted to know if this was because this has been tough because it's your source of income. I mean, you know, when in the beginning, nobody knows you. Nobody knows what these are. The Labyrinth Society was just starting out too. Veriditas, it hadn't grown and to what it is today. So I can imagine.
Yeah, it's been our only source of income since '98. So it's not just a major one; it's the only one. Mm-hmm. So Debbie and I both worked very hard at it to make it successful since '98. But it has definitely grown in enthusiasm. But yeah, what she was talking about was financially. There's ebbs and flows. There's times when we have a backlog of six of them that's, you know, a year and a half worth of effort. And then there's times when we'll go six, eight, several months without hearing from anyone. So it tends to go in bunches and ebb and flow in an inconsistent manner. Mm. Not like the tide that you can count on. It just... We just have to have faith, knowing that in the thin times, we know that it'll straighten out down the road a little bit. The tide will come back in.
And as you have become more well-known and your labyrinths have been walked and your name well-known, I'm sure that also has changed a bit. Tell me a little bit about moving. Now, we always talk about labyrinths being temporary and permanent, you know, and the difference between the two of them. And the temporary ones are made out of sticks or on the sand or whatever. But even the permanent ones, it's been my experience, and I know it's been yours, aren't so permanent, really. It depends on where they are and who owns the property and what their plans are if somebody sells the property, etc. So You were just involved with moving the permanent labyrinth in Galveston from one location to the other because that property was sold, and that's going to be on the post-gathering labyrinth tour on November 13th. Can you tell us a little bit about that aspect of your work?
We build it. Our intention when we put them in is to make them permanent and not be able to be moved. But because of this specific instance that you mentioned, and all the effort from Kay Sandor and her wonderful group of on her committee, they just simply weren't going to let this labyrinth that was at the Episcopalian Chapel at the University of Texas, they just weren't going to let it be destroyed. The property was sold. They talked the developer who bought the property into giving them time to try to find a home for it. They went to, committee meetings from everything from city council to the Rotary Club looking for any kind of help, answers, thoughts, anybody to help them save it. And eventually they found a Methodist church on the other end of town, decided that they would like to save it for the city of Galveston. So it went from an Episcopalian property to a Methodist property, which I find as cool as can be. But even more than that, it, to me, is the fact that there was citizens in the community that just simply would not let this thing go. They were going to save it one way or the other. And it took them a long time to do it, but they did indeed save it. Probably the most unique thing about it was created originally in the very early days of our labyrinth construction. So it wasn't quite as accurate and precise, and I wasn't as knowledgeable about the subject then as I am now. So in the instance of moving it, I had to recreate the flaws flawlessly. There were no extra bricks. There's no extra anything to work with. These are the pieces. They need to go back exactly where they came from. So it was flawlessly recreating flaws, which was pretty difficult to do. I'm really not looking forward to doing it a lot of other times. Hopefully they'll all stay where they're at.
Let's see. How long did this take you?
We thought it would take 4 weeks, and it took us 6. It was a really involved process. I had a friend of mine who's really talented and very thoughtful about things come and help me, and we work well together, and he helped me, Dave is his name, Dave Keller, he helped me take it. We literally made one Bobcat trailer trip a day. We picked them up, placed them exactly where they came from on the trailer, took them to the other end of the island, and then put them back exactly where they went. But because there was sand and sealer and all sorts of things stuck to the side, we had to literally clean every brick, all 4 sides of every brick. Something like 17,000 pieces had to be cleaned.
Wow. Oh, my golly. Wow. Yes, I can see why you don't want to have to do that again.
No, not really. I hope they all just stay home.
Right.
I mean, I would do it rather than lose one, of course, but it would be nice if they could all just remain in their happy homes.
Yeah. So, but with the other location now where you had to put it, now you had to completely create a foundation for that first. So you had to do all that work first.
Prep work at the new site had to be done before we even picked up a single brick.
Right.
So that we could take it over and immediately put it in place.
Right. And then you put sealer on top of it and the rest of it once it was in place.
Yes. As a matter of fact, when we left, it looks brand new. It looks really nice in its new home. And the proudest moment of it all is that the people in Galveston still have it to enjoy. They keep it open and available. It's in a nice little gated sanctuary place that they keep the gates open and have a security person there most of the time. And it's just a really nice home for it, and it's open for everyone.
Now, did they have any kind of ceremony when this happened? Or did they invite this? How did the community, I know you talked about Kay Sandor, but how did the community support you? Were they there during the process? Did they help? Did anyone help? Or did they have a ceremony or anything like that once it was in place?
There was a few small ceremonies during the process, but the part that stuck out to me the most was when we would go to get our to-go food after the end of a long day when we were exhausted. I mean, virtually every restaurant we were standing in waiting to get our to-go food, because of our Labyrinths and Stone t-shirts, we were recognized as the fellas that had come to save their labyrinth. Every restaurant. you'd be standing there, oh, you're those guys that are saving it. Thank you so much. And it literally happened daily. It was a phenomenon that was created by Kay and her committee. And the local newspapers, of course, being open to telling their story.
That's wonderful. Wonderful description. So let's talk more about the effects of these labyrinths in the communities. I used the photo I asked you for some photos, and Debbie sent me a couple. And the one that I used for the image for this episode is the one of the World Labyrinth Day Pinwheel Labyrinth with the rain barrel in the center. So let's talk a little bit about that and your experiences with that and your involvement with that and for our guests here today.
Well, we wanted to do something special for World Labyrinth Day in our community. So I brought it up to some people on the city and the city board. And I said I would love to do a labyrinth. I didn't know what we were going to make them out of yet or make it out of yet. I just knew we were going to have a labyrinth. Well, there was a citywide thing going on with rain barrels at that time, all to do with being more green and, saving water and preserving. And so they were painting these rain barrels and auctioning them off and selling them around the city. And so I came up with this idea to use pinwheels because I thought it would be very fun for the children and
very cost effective.
To be honest with you, Marty did not like the idea. He thought, what are these windmills going to be with these little pinwheels going to be doing? It's going to be too much energy. It's going to be too crazy. You know, he didn't like the idea at all. But I knew it had some potential.
I was wrong.
So I moved forward with it, and I ordered, I think it was 600 pinwheels from Oriental Trading. So they arrived in boxes, and I opened them up, and they just had these smile faces on them, and they were so happy and cheerful. I'm like, this is going to be so much fun. So I found a couple volunteers, and Marty helped me get it painted on the grass first, and then we just took and stuck the pinwheels along the line, measured it out. I think we used a stick to measure it out with. And then we just stuck them in, and here was this beautiful pinwheel. So what happened was on World Labyrinth Day, people brought their pocket change. So whatever pocket change you could come, some, you know, we had children bringing their like jars that they'd been saving their money in. And in the center of the labyrinth was the rain barrel, and people put their pocket change in there. And then that money went to providing more rain barrels to paint and spread around the city. So that's how that all came about.
And so, but with the rain barrels, do you have to use a special gutter system or something? Don't you have to, or it doesn't matter, just as long as it's the end of where the water comes down off the building, right?
Yeah, these rain barrels were designed for that, so people could just take them home and, you know, and install them very easily and quickly.
Yeah, there's a little filter on the top of the rain barrel to keep out the debris as it comes out of the gutters and downspouts.
Okay.
Pretty simple system, and they seem to go over pretty well. So they're all over our city now. But I love the fact that people walked the labyrinth, arrived in the center, and then were able to give back.
Yeah, a nice multi-layered thing.
Yeah.
World Labyrinth Day, pinwheels, rain barrels, a lot of layers of happiness. I was opposed to it because they seem labyrinths were more prayerful, more serious, a more thoughtful walk. But I was wrong because the happiness and cheerfulness of the pinwheels made it a joyful, playful, happy experience versus so much of the inner reflective type thing that we're so used to with labyrinths. It was more of a playful, fun thing, which was glorious and beautiful in its own way.
So I don't, we're getting, it's only 10:23. So I'd like to talk more about some of your individual, like you have like 28 different or something. Let me see what I wrote down here. 28 states and countries where you've installed labyrinths on your website. So talk a little bit, what about that one in Mexico? What was that one about? Can you give us a little bit of a fill in about some of these experiences you've had in some of these other states and other places, you know, from start to finish. So you get this call or you get a letter, and then what happens?
Well, the one in Mexico City was pretty unique situation because, for one thing, it's the only corporate labyrinth, really, for an insurance company in Mexico City. And I believe they have around 5,000 employees. And the labyrinth is there to help nurture and to keep their employees healthy, both body, mind, and spirit. And I love the fact that a corporate headquarters would, you know, want to do that for their employees. And to me, it's brilliant. You know, if you're going to nurture and keep them happy and healthy, then they're going to be, you know, better employees. They're going to miss less work. So they're all about that there. And the thing that sticks out in my mind, Marty made that labyrinth pretty much alone. He had one person there that they had assigned to him, but he created that entire labyrinth with not much help at all. And they honored him so much there. They took such good care of him while he was in Mexico City. It was pretty scary. You know, I mean, anybody that found out he was going to be in Mexico City making a labyrinth, they were like, oh my goodness, you know, they were just, aren't you worried about him? You know, what if? And what they did, though, was they did not let him out of their sight. He had an interpreter that traveled with him every place. They kept him so safe and so well taken care of. And then when they had the dedication, they flew me in and they treated us like rock stars. I mean, they were just so wonderful to us in every way that they could be. It was a really beautiful experience there.
Yeah, the dedication there was every magazine, newspaper, virtually every media outlet in Mexico City was at the dedication. It was, when we were speaking, it was almost like paparazzi with the flashbulbs going off and stuff. It was a unexpected and unique experience. But the one thing I want to point out about it is that it was, they actually first called Robert Ferret about another labyrinth maker about making that labyrinth, and he felt that it was better suited to our style of making labyrinths with pavers and stones. So he gave us a wonderful testimonial saying that we were the best there is. When I went to the meeting in Mexico, they literally said that we were told you were the best there is. So we brought you down here to do this, and it was very nice to be so respected and honored when we got there. It really was like being a rock star. I had to come home and take out the garbage.
back to the mundane. Can you just give us a picture, you know, describe a visual image of what, where it was and what type of labyrinth it is and the materials used?
Sure. The insurance company is now located on used to be the University of Mexico in Mexico City, but after their big earthquake 20-some years ago, the university decided to rebuild, and the insurance company bought that property. So what they did in this one of the sports complexes at the university, they turned it into a state-of-the-art health club for their employees, and they literally give them bonuses on their check for going to the health club. So instead of paying to go there, you get paid to go there. And right outside of that space is the labyrinth, so that your spiritual health and your physical health can be nurtured in the same place or near each other. Mm. And because they have such a diverse, the dominant Catholic religion there, but there's many types or many religions and aspects of humanity represented there, that what was decided was to put in a seven-path classic and a full chart labyrinth. So both of them are there in the same place so that you can choose which one you prefer to walk. So trying to nurture everyone, not just a specific religion.
Wow. And this is brick or paver or terrazzo? What is it made out of?
All pavers. The whole thing is made of pavers with clay lines. There's concrete pavers for the path and clay pavers for the lines and highlights. Yeah. you can see a few nice pictures of it on our website if anyone's interested in looking at it. The two of, I think there's a photo of both labyrinths in the same frame.
So you've mentioned now two different distinct things. So you have here one where the labyrinth's being used to address issues of conservation and ecology with the World Labyrinth Day. Now you have one that's addressing the issues of health and well-being in the corporate setting. So that's another great example. What's another one that you can of all the labyrinths that you've made that you can another example of how labyrinths are being used?
The one that comes to mind to me first is Walter Reed, the new Walter Reed Hospital, which is nurturing and caring for our veterans and all of the people who care for our veterans and their families. The experience there that Marty had, and again, he made that labyrinth pretty much by himself. He, in fact, didn't have any help on that one. It was just amazing, the work that he did. He had to take all of his material in through the hospital to the courtyard area, which is called Angel Garden. And every single piece of material, every brick, everything, every piece of sand had to go through the busy hallway where there are doctors and pregnant women and veterans. And he created that entire labyrinth with all of that chaos around him.
Wow.
Being there with all of our veterans in various states of healing was a pretty humbling experience. You can't leave there and not be a changed person. You just can't.
And so there's no access to this garden except through the main corridor.
There's several doors into it, but you have to be inside the hospital itself. It's a very guarded place. It's where all our president and all of our senators and congresspeople get their health care. As a matter of fact, I had to park about a mile and a half away because there was 11,000 contractors working on this hospital, as you can imagine. And I had to park a long ways away because they were there before I was. And it became clear to the people in charge that it was ridiculous I was so far away. So one day they made a decision that I could park in this one very specific parking place that was outside of Angel Garden, outside of a glass hallway. And I found out later the reason that parking place was always open, it's because that's where the president's limo parks when he visits the hospital. But being wasn't there, I was able to park there. So I felt pretty honored to be able to put my pickup truck in his space.
Wow. So did you, and what kind of labyrinth did you install there?
It's a full replica of a Chart labyrinth with very precise details. It also has clay lines. I love the concrete pavers are a little rougher and maybe fade a little bit in the sun over time, and the clay pavers have a completely different texture and they're more bathed in color. And I think that the opposing textures and colors and the way light reflects off of them is beautiful. So I really like making labyrinths with those two materials, and that's what we were able to use there.
And what color are the lines?
They're clay bricks that are made of black clay, and then they have iron baked onto the surface of them that makes it look sort of like black chrome. So it kind of changes colors all the time based on what the sky is doing or what time of day you're there. In the morning, you get more pinks and teal or Easter-type colors, and in the evening, you get more greens and blues. And at midday sun, if the sky is clear, you see a nice baby blue on it, so it's literally reflecting its environment.
And so how did you you were asked to do this by whom in the hospital? Who contacted you?
It would have been all the religious folks that
chaplains
and everyone that administers to the needs of the soldiers felt that there was a need for it. So that was the push that got us there.
Well, they also have a labyrinth across the street from the hospital at the...
Still on the...
It's an indoor one made out of wood. It's beautiful inlaid. And this is where the soldiers go. I'm drawing a blank.
Intrepid
something of
for excellence.
Excellence.
Intrepid. Something intrepid
Center
for excellence.
For excellence.
Yeah.
And they nurture everything about the veterans in there, and they have a beautiful indoor labyrinth. So they were using that before they wanted the permanent outdoor labyrinth, which actually came about from one of the chaplains, Donahue. She arrived at the hospital at Walter Reed, and there was a perfect circle that had nothing in it. And she would envision a labyrinth being there. And sure enough, while she was on duty there, she was able to watch the labyrinth come to be born. And there's one other thing I would like to say about that project, and I'd like Marty to talk about this because he was there. They did some beautiful ceremony around the labyrinth with prayers. And they put out an email, and they asked everyone in the hospital, all the people that worked there, and also some the patients and families, to write blessings and prayers on paper. And then Marty was actually able to help them facilitate a ceremony where they did a burning bowl, and they burned all these prayers and wishes, and they are in the center of that labyrinth.
The ashes from that were placed in the center of the labyrinth, so they'll always be there underneath of the pavers in the on top of the base material.
Oh.
So they'll always be there.
Oh, that's wonderful. How wonderful.
Yeah, it's very nice. An emotional time just being there and seeing some of those prayers and stuff was a pretty emotional time for everyone involved. Something I would like to say about that project is you talked earlier about how labyrinth enthusiasm has grown over the years. So in the early days, you would talk about labyrinths and one in 10,000 people might know what one was. I mean, we felt like we were really isolated, and there was very few people that really knew of them or understood them. And then 15 years later, because of the wonderful efforts, input, and enthusiasm for labyrinths from not only the Labyrinth Society and Veritas folks and every labyrinth enthusiast that's ever wanted to mow one behind their church or put one or talk about them or use them, all of their combination of efforts made it possible for us to be the ones honored enough to have our own federal government, from not knowing what one is all the way to our own federal government calling us and asking us if we can put a labyrinth right smack in the middle of their new state-of-the-art hospital in Angel Garden. That's a long ways to travel in 15 years.
Yeah. Yes.
So we all deserve the credit, not just Debbie and I, for this being there. Every single labyrinth enthusiast was a part of it.
Hmm. And did you, so when you are at these dedications, and when you're, do you have, like, did you have a veteran come up to you and talk to you or describe their experience walking the labyrinth? I know that they're using them for trauma, head trauma patients of vets in Oregon and at the VA hospital there. And so using labyrinths for them. And so I was wondering if any of the injured vets actually talk to you about their experiences?
I left shortly after it was completed, so I didn't really have a lot of time to be there while they were using it. And it's such a secure location that you can't just go in and hang out. You literally need to get through several layers of security to be there. Part of the problem was the door I wanted to take the material in and out of that Debbie was talking about had a code, and they would not let me prop that door open, so I had to punch the code every single time I wanted to go through this door with a wheelbarrow of gravel or bricks or whatever. It was quite an ordeal.
Oh my God.
But as I was finishing, they wanted me to remove every piece of material that I'd taken in. I could not leave any debris in Angel Garden of any kind, not a sand pile, not an anything. So I was hauling the extras back out and putting them in a dumpster, and a veteran walked up to me. this is kind of a tough story. I don't know if you really want me to tell it, but if you really want to hear it, I'll say what he had to say. He asked if he could walk the labyrinth after I explained to him what it was. He had no idea. He said he could really use some of what a labyrinth stood for. So he asked if he could walk it. I said, of course, you'll be the first one. And while I'm hauling my stuff out of here, you're more than welcome to walk it. When he came out, he told me of how powerful it was for him. And he told me about his very traumatic experience he had suffered. He didn't appear to have any wounds, which I found unique because most of the soldiers I had met were wounded in some way. I was right outside the amputee ward, so it was a lot of obvious injuries to these soldiers, and I know they had injuries that weren't as obvious too. But this gentleman told me of being in charge and accountable for a lot of young men. And I won't go into all kinds of graphic details that he did, but the bottom line is he lost every single one of them, and he's the only one that survived. And as you can imagine, he's struggling with it. The accountability to families and relatives and friends that he feels, maybe not justified, but he feels it, whether it is or not. So... yeah, I'm sure it's being used in tons and tons of ways, but that was the one that I experienced, and it was profound.
Wow. Yeah, aren't we blessed to be able to direct people to this wonderful tool that will take the energy and absorb it and provide something in return?
Absolutely.
He did express that he felt much better for the experience, and he felt like it had had a positive effect on his outlook. Mm-hmm. I'm just hoping that he was able to take that with him and have it not be the experience that he had in war not be detrimental to the rest of his life, I hope.
Mm. So it's almost 10, it's 10:41. But I don't have anyone coming actually wanting to chat at this point. So let's talk a little bit about what do you think? I mean, you're in this world all the time, 24/7. Debbie, I know that you do ritual and ceremony, and you are, you know, the energy chair of the Energy Keepers for the Labyrinth Society, and are very involved with opening and closing ceremonies all the time. But so what do you think is the reason for this upsurge in interests over the past few years? I mean, you know, I mean, out of just, you know, what is your feeling about this? What do you think is why this is occurring now at this time?
Well, part of what I think it is partly is our world has just become so crazy with technology. You know, the internet, the cell phones, every time people have them in their hands constantly, people are being bombarded. And I think people love the labyrinth because it's simple. It's it's time out from all the craziness. It's time just to have a still moment in the center of that labyrinth that we cannot seem to find many places. And I think that people are really turning to that. And Jeff Sayward, actually, there's a quote from him, and I'm not going to remember it word for word, but it's about how throughout history, you know, when things have become...
Times of uncertainty.
And right now with technology and everything, and that's when people tend to turn towards the labyrinth. And I feel like it just keeps increasing more and more. I know myself with technology, I'm struggling with it every day. And when I can take a finger labyrinth even and just take a minute to center myself and to calm myself, it's one of the best things I can do for myself each day.
In addition to that, I'd like to add that I think if people would have known what labyrinths were 30 years ago, they would have used them. But the enthusiasm grows. You know, one person tells two, two tells five, so on and so forth, has allowed it to blossom. It's a wonderful tool that everyone would have used, I think, and with the abandon that they are now, but they didn't know. And as soon as they found out, they embrace it. And it seems to be growing and growing and growing in that respect, that I think they would have used it in 95 and 92 and 82 had they been aware that they existed. There was a need. They just didn't know where to find relief.
Yes, and now with Facebook and the internet, all that technology that is driving some of us crazy is also very a wonderful way to spread the word about labyrinths. And it just seems like you plant one seed and they just blossom.
I was shocked at how many labyrinths are on Pinterest. I'm not much of a technology person. I'm more of a rock chopper personally. But Debbie had me on Pinterest the other day, and I was absolutely stunned at how many people had full pages of labyrinths from across the world and vacations and other places. It really is a phenomenon that's happening globally.
So speaking of that and this global surge, upsurge of labyrinth use, and talk to me a little about how the technology of building it has changed. I know that there is now, I just saw it on our Facebook page, I mean, I think in the global group, that there's that new spreadable fluorescent incandescent paint or something that you can use that can light up can be mixed with the material for the paths, and so the paths will be lit at night, will light up at night?
It sounds interesting. We've not pursued it very much. We've been talking with about putting a labyrinth at Space Camp, and we talked to them about maybe using some of that to generate constellations in the background behind the labyrinth. So it ties in a little bit more with their mission there. So we've not really had much experience with it, but I think it would be fun to play with.
Yeah. And so what are some of the installations that you're planning that are on your plate or in line now that you have coming up?
Well, there's one that I would like Marty to speak about, to talk about, that he's working on now. And it's a really cool project from Olatree, Italy, from a fresco that Jeff Sayward has documented and he's photographed. And Marty is working on a carving, actually finishing it up right now, of that. Would you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. As Debbie said, Jeff Sayward took a wonderful photograph of this fresco that had been hidden. It's thought to be a little bit older than Labyrinth and Chart, but it has the exact same pass sequence. It doesn't have the fancy rosette center, and it doesn't have lunations, but it has the exact same pass sequence. And if it's a couple hundred years older, as it's thought to be, then that maybe was a precursor to the medieval cathedral labyrinth that went in Chart. And we were in St. Helena. I couldn't think of that. St. Helena, California, and making a labyrinth at a private residence that was being created. And Debbie showed this fresco to the gentleman that we were making it for. And it's a very Byzantine image of Christ. And his wife is very big on that, so he asked if I could carve it in stone. And I said, sure, not having any idea how I could do it. So I've been working on it for a long time. I actually started to make it originally a little more three-dimensional than I should have, and our client pointed out that it looked a little more Catholic than Eastern Orthodox, so I started over on the center part. And I've actually become a better artist or carver because of it, because that style of art is incredibly flat, and it's about the economy of lines. You get very few lines. You need to really make them count, and you're trying to make the image of an entire body, and you only have 3/4 of an inch of depth, which isn't even the depth of a human nose. So it really makes you sort of carve in a way that you're painting with shadows, I guess is what it comes down to. You're thinking about the shadows that the lines you create are going to make. And I think I've become a more well-rounded artist because of it. it's almost done, and I'm so anxious to take it there and hang it on the wall behind the beautiful labyrinth that we made for them at their residence in her spiritual sanctuary. I was really hoping that we would have photographs of it for the gathering coming up, but I don't think I'm going to be able to deliver it to California till right after the gathering, so that's not going to happen. But it's still beautiful, and we'll get to show it at some point.
Yeah, I was a member of the Trinity Labyrinth Guild of the Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland, and they have a huge iconography department there. And they have many artists that spend a year creating in the school there, creating icons. And then we have there's every year in the beginning of December, there's an icon walk that starts in one part of the cathedral and comes into the labyrinth. And the icons are all arranged all around the labyrinth. And people walk in between the icons and have a labyrinth walk and can stop at different places to meditate at the icon. So I know a little bit about them because of that. And they are quite fascinating and quite lovely. And they are very much a process of going inward and getting to the heart of the image, of the emotion of that image, and putting it on a very flat style. Yeah, so that's very interesting, fascinating that you're doing that.
What I've learned, that it's not about the artist, and it's not about how beautiful you can carve it. It's about the story that's being told by the image.
Can you give me we got about 5 more minutes. Can you give me an example, Marty or Debbie, of something there must have been times when there were issues or when there were things that came up that you didn't feel were able to be solved or resolved. Did that happen very often with you in the installation or with working with your clients, or were you able to pretty much trust the labyrinth and trust that process, and it all pretty much work out for you with each one?
I can think of 2 of them right off, and I'll tell the first one very quickly. We were doing a little segment for HGTV, their curb appeal show, where we put a little 9-foot labyrinth at the front of a row house in Washington, D.C., not far from the Capitol building. And when the truck arrived with the bricks, we were going to start filming a big segment in the morning. And when the bricks arrived the previous afternoon, they had actually sent me some of the wrong bricks. So I called the manufacturer that donated our bricks, and literally by the very next morning, all the way from Chicago to D.C., they had the bricks that we needed. So I didn't solve it. Our manufacturer that works with us did. But that was one of them that I felt was going to be unsolvable, but they solved it for us. The other one that comes to mind is this same project in Napa that I'm talking about, where the carving goes. I made a mistake. I was overconfident, and I didn't rethink and rethink and rethink before I laid I don't make the center first. I literally make the inside line and the inside path first, and then go back and put in the center later. I'm able to keep it a truer circle that way. And I mismeasured. I put it one line width too far in, meaning I measured to the outside instead of the inside of the brick. And I made a mistake. And it was huge. And I was sick to my stomach. For one thing, I had made a mistake. For another thing, I couldn't trust myself anymore. What am I going to do? I can't think of a solution. I need to pick this whole labyrinth. I didn't realize it till I was almost done making the labyrinth, which was the frightening part. And it was a struggle. I mean, I was about to have a breakdown. And I finally got up the courage to call the client and tell them that I had made a mistake, that their center was going to be approximately 6 inches smaller than we had anticipated. And they said, "So what's the big deal? We're not all about that so much. It'll be beautiful the way it is. We trust you, and do your fine work that you always do, and it'll be as beautiful, if not more beautiful, than the intention. Mm-hmm. So all my stress and worry and illness and ranting and raving and stomping around was for nothing. We just happened to have such gracious hosts that it was not a big deal in any way, shape, or form. And they've been that way throughout the entire process, working for them. From creating the labyrinth and sending their first deposit check to being patient while I make this carving.
Actually, the labyrinth feels better that way. We forgot that part.
Oh, yeah. It was a Seventh Circuit Chart Essence Labyrinth, and I've always been making the center an exact size of Chart so that it felt just like Chart, and the same path width, same line width, everything, except there's three less circuits on the outside. So a labyrinth, the center of Chart should be 1/4 of the overall diameter. And it was not correct because I kept the center the same size, even though the labyrinth got smaller. And by shrinking that center, that 6 inches, it actually looks more to scale and more proportional. So I think I'll probably make them all that way from now on.
Divine intervention, yeah. Christiana.
I would say that counts, that qualifies as just that, for sure. Just that.
It happens a lot.
And now literally an image of God that I've carved is going to be looking down on the labyrinth that divine inspiration came about in. So it's all pretty apropos, a word I learned from David Gallagher.
Oh, great. Well, thank you, Marty and Debbie, so much for joining me today. This has been wonderful, and I so look forward to seeing you in Houston in November, and enjoying your presentation there, and of course Debbie, our being on the board with you is lovely. So I just wanted to thank you again, and please be well, and many continued blessings on your path.
Thank you, Christiana, and the same to you. And again, thank you to the Labyrinth Society for, you know, everything that they've done to support and to bring labyrinths to the world. We're so appreciative.
Okay.
Almost to every labyrinth we've made, someone from the Labyrinth Society brought it to us, informed the client or customer about us. Almost every, I mean, literally 90% of the labyrinths we've made, somehow, if you trace it back, comes from someone in the Labyrinth Society of Veriditas. Very few, just someone from that loved a labyrinth went to our website and found us. Almost all of them come from someone who sent that prospective commissioner to us. Mm-hmm. So we're very thankful to all of them. I'd like to start naming names, but surely I'd leave one off. So I think I'll avoid that and just include everyone.
Okay.
Robert has had a huge impact on our career as one. Him and Jeff Sayward both have just been phenomenal for us. Jeff and Kim Sayward.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And you have a wonderful day and rest of your week, and be well.
Thank you. You too, Christiana.
Bye-bye.
Back to working on our presentation.
Okay, bye-bye. You've been listening to the Labyrinth Society's Many Paths, Many Visions, broadcast by Spreaker, with your host, Christiana Brinton. Be sure to check the Labyrinth Society website, their Facebook page and global group, and YouTube for a list of upcoming dates and guests. For more information, please go to www.labyrinthsociety.org. Ciao. Namaste, and may you find what you need on your path through life.